Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for over 44 years. Every Sunday night at around 8 o'clock, we sit ourselves in front of the radio and we chat with each other. We learn from each other. We teach each other and we entertain each other. And I thank you once again for joining me this particular Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second and I will return with the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, that would be for mailbag questions, for TechNet puzzles, or if you want to volunteer to discuss some technical expertise that's made it into the news that you'd like to share with others, or if you'd like me to just tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at his face and ask a related story. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to reach Paul directly, his email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. We also offer a bunch of link sites to interesting articles, occasionally YouTubes and such. So any old time that you want to, we keep it up there forever and ever. If you've got a touch of insomnia and would like to read some articles I found interesting, type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that will bring you my link page. We also offer a chat room. Sometimes it's active, sometimes it's quiet. You can never really predict it. You can reach it by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. And we also offer a internet audio stream of the technical net, so that if you don't have a radio or if you're out of radio distance, you could just go to the website and listen to the audio stream, and we keep it live the rest of the week because a few people asked me to, so you don't need necessarily a handy-talkie to listen into Glen Oaks through the week. You can just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that will bring you to the audio stream. And as always, I like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of guys who are very, very smart that moved out of the area or unfortunately become silent keys over the years. Their wisdom remains in audio files on Mike's website. So check it out when you have some spare time. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what we got planned for tonight. Okay, a usual vanilla edition. In this case, it's the Emmy edition of the Limark Technical Net. I have a couple of comments to make about the technical subjects that we discussed last week. There's pretty much nothing going on in AI, surprisingly. Except people repeating the idea that it's a bubble that's going to burst one of these days, and other people saying that it might be bursting as you read the article. So a lot of people try a lot of different things for clickbait, and I'm sure eventually they'll get it right. After we cover that, we'll go into our usual questions, comments, and topics. I'll ask for people to hit the push to talk, give me your first name, your call sign, whether it's amateur radio related or science and technology related. It would be nice if the first few questions are amateur radio related. I will write them down and we'll try and have the people present their question or comment or topic in order. You know, some people are really stuck for time and they need to go on earlier. We can make adjustments, but that should hopefully take us to approximately 10:15. Paul, WS2N, will join us with the SpaceNet report. That should take us approximately to 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan. If the repeater is working right and I'm working right and the shack is working right, and, of course, I don't get kicked off of All-Star too many times. So that's the idea. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what I got from last week's technical discussion. Okay. It was we had a discussion with Rich W2BZ. One of the things he was talking about was different ways of winding a toroid. For a common mode choke, he saw on YouTube that some people, rather than just coil it around from one end of the toroid to the other, they stopped midway and they extended the wire to the other end of the toroid, and then they continued to wrap it around on that side of the toroid back to where it was previously crossed over. And he wanted to know a couple of things about that. And I suggested that primarily my understanding was it was a mechanical thing, so that you get the two ends of the toroid at opposing sides, and so it's a cleaner way of dealing with things, putting it in a box, having the input in one end and the output in the other end. Let me drop for a sec. Further investigation found out that this thing is usually known as a split RF winding toroid. And in addition to the mechanical aspects, by winding it in this interesting way, you know, across the diameter to the other side and then back again, lessens the amount of parasitic capacitance that the toroid will have for the inductor. And usually if you can get rid of some of the parasitic capacitance, the balun will have a better attenuation, a more consistent common mode current attenuation across the bandwidth. Otherwise, if you just wind it in one direction to the end, as you go up in frequency, the attenuation suffers a little bit, and depending upon how wide the bandwidth you need to get common mode suppression and attenuation, it's a good practice to wind it that way. You get a little bit more function out of RF choke that way. So that's an answer to Rich W2BZ's, that it improves the parasitic capacitance of a RF choke. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, George WB2IKT mentioned that he had remembered hearing about having a balun with a center tap that went to ground, and that would be beneficial. But I think he talked to people that made balun for a living who were trying to dissuade him from that experiment. I wasn't able to find a lot of technical details of it. But there are mentions throughout the Internet. They're more anecdotal. They speak of that there's a benefit to that type of design for a balun. It dissipates static electricity from the antenna elements to the ground system. So it seems to be a reasonable thing to do, although that article itself mentioned that although it's a useful feature, most people don't avail themselves of it. So there is such a thing as a balun with a center tap that provides a little bit improved function by dissipating static electricity. So that's kind of two technical subjects that we talked about last week that I just wanted to add a little bit to. Now, if anyone has any comments to either of those things, feel free to hit the push to talk before we move on to the next section of the technical net.
WA2VDH with a quick comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that if anybody wants to do some further reading on it, and this book has been mentioned before, Jerry Sevick's book, W2FMI, his book, Transmission Line Transformers, has a nice section there on balance and all of the related topics. It's an excellent book.
Yeah, he also has a book that's specifically labeled balun, and he just kind of draws different designs of balun, which is fascinating to look at. And I you know, some of these designs are so Rube Goldberg that I can't really follow the circuits very well.
Yeah, I don't have this other book, but I remember I got this book a few years ago, Transmission Line Transformers. Very good reading. That's the only comment I have.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I would agree. Get one of those two books. I don't know if you're going to be able to particularly understand and build your own from scratch, but it's a good starting if you want to just copy designs that have worked through the years. He in that particular one that's titled Balance, he offers a whole bunch of different designs that you can just copy from the pages of the book. Any other comments before we move on?
BZ?
Yes, Rich?
Just put me on the list, Roy. I don't know if you called it already. I'm coming in late.
Okay, we haven't gotten to the list yet, but that's fine. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
Oh, Charlie 2, Delta Alpha Whiskey.
Yeah, this isn't for checking in. This is if you have any questions, comments, or topics for tonight.
Okay, sorry about that. Actually, I do, but I'll wait my turn.
Okay, I'll put you on the list. What else that again?
Oh, Charlie 2, Delta Alpha Whiskey.
Okay, very good. I got you down. Anyone else? Anyone else want to go on the list? I heard someone that was a lot of static, but try again.
Hilo Bravo 3, Yankee Victor Oscar.
You got a question or a comment for tonight?
I just want to be in everything.
You got a lot of noise. Time before I could make out most of it. This time it was all noise. You want to try again?
I just want to be in a list.
I'm afraid about 90-95% noise. Try and see if you can adjust things. The first transmission was decent. It was good. I don't know why it got noisier. Time went on. Maybe you changed your position. If you're using a whip or something, you can put it closer to the window or something. Once again, let me just try and figure out. Do you have a question for tonight, or are you just checking in?
Just checking in. I just want to know. I'm just going to be listening because I don't have a good transmission right now. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Please hit that push to talk. Give me your call sign and your first name, and if it's circulated and or amateur radio related. Okay, well, we'll start with Rich and KC2DAW and see how things go. Hopefully more people will check in, more people will have any questions or comments or topics. Rich, what can I do you for?
Roy, go to the next person. I'm in the middle of something. I didn't expect it to come up this quick.
Okay, KC2DAW, what do you got for us tonight?
Okay, thank you. The question that I need is answered is that I have this radio. And I've ordered the interface unit for the computer. I need to know what kind of program can I get for digital communications.
Okay, can you tell me what kind of radio it is?
The Zgear G106.
Okay, so that's a Zhegu. It's a Chinese radio, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Unfortunately, I've never had one. I've never used one, so I'm not quite 100% sure what kind of interface it needs. I am sure. Well, it depends. What kind of digital modes are you talking about? When you say digital modes, are you speaking of things like FT8 or some other type of thing, like RIDI is considered an older but a digital mode. So any particular digital mode you're kind of considering?
Not really sure. That's the problem. I'm not, because I don't even know. I'm just getting started with this. I guess the standard basic for I guess call letter or something. I'm not even sure. KC2DAW.
Okay. Well, like I said, I don't exactly own one, so I've never used it, but. But there are, if you simply Google, running something like FT8 with the Zhegu G106, it'll probably show you a couple of interface, they have these little digipeater type of interfaces, and when you buy it from the manufacturer, they have different wirings for different model radios, and you can kind of look up 106. And you can buy the connector package and the little control box that offers what you basically need for a lot of the digital modes on HF is something that will take the audio signal and turn it into a digital stream that will be able to be manipulated on your computer. So it's something with usually audio jacks or an accessory connector at one end and a bunch of USB connector on the other. So you get the G106 connector wire kit along with the little controller box. It gives you instructions. You plug it in to the radio. The output of the little controller goes into USB. Then when you install software into your computer, there'll be a installation instructions, and it will open a window, and you can select the virtual audio driver for the input and for the output. It's usually the most important thing. Also, push-to-talk controls usually are there. And by setting up, and it's unfortunately slightly different for every type of digital mode that you got. But, there are a lot of YouTubes that will show you how to properly operate the setup window and have the right virtual audio devices hooked up to your computer, and then it shouldn't be that difficult. But, ultimately it depends upon the particular type of digital mode you're interested in. They're all different pieces of software, and they all have their little strangenesses here or there. But, if you Google it, you can find a lot of software that's open source, that's free. The problem is figuring out the little gotchas for each of them. And like I said, there are a lot of web pages, there are a lot of forums, and worst comes to worst, you could try YouTube as well. So I hope that helped. Again, I'm not exactly sure what these little devices are, but if you just type in how do I get Zhegu 106 to decode FT8 and such, I'm sure they'll mention these interfaces. They usually go for about $60-$80.
Okay, thank you. I already ordered it. It's already coming. But I just wanted the software part, the program.
Well, again, it sort of depends upon what you want to do with it. If you want to do FT8, then you would just Google WS. WSTP or something? Whatever kind of mode, because there's lots of them. There's RIDI, as I mentioned. There's phase shift keying, different types. There's a lot of them. So you kind of have to decide what you want. The most popular digital mode, as far as I'm aware right now these days, is FT8. So you just Google FT8 to download, and there's a master program that offers you a whole bunch of Joe Taylor software, and it's free. So if you're interested in FT8, just Google it and download it. It's very simple.
BZ?
Yeah, Rich?
The most popular one of all by far, is WSJTX. I think that's the one you were looking for, Roy. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, again, if you just type in download FT8 software, you'll find yourself in the same place. But yeah, WS, geez, I'm blocking so badly today. WSPT dash X, is that it?
No, it's WSJT, like January. WSJTX.
Okay, don't know why I'm blocking, but WSJTX. So that'll give you a whole bunch of Joe Taylor's other software and the ability to open up a browser and do a quick search for activity in the last hour or the last 3 hours or the last 6 hours or 12 hours. So WSJT is a very good all-in-one type of Joe Taylor piece of software. But, you know, there are other bits of software. There's a guy who took the FT8 source code that Joe Taylor offers for everyone to play around with, and he embedded some text windows into it, text fields. And so if you want to actually have a very slow conversation with someone, you can try JS8 call. Although I've looked around and, you know, maybe even 40 meters there's some activity, but on 20 it seems to be dead, and 10 it seems to be a dead thing. But, okay, try WSJTX, and, you know, like I said, you'll find that there's loads of other digital modes out there, but that's the number one most popular one. I look at the spectrum every chance I get, and I've never seen it quiet. On 20 meters, the frequency that that FT8 is operating on, so always have transmissions going on.
Hey, thank you, both of y'all. Thank you for the info and stuff. I'll start looking it up. Thank you. Okay, KC2DAW.
Okay, good luck, Curtis. I'm sure you'll have loads of fun with it, and if you have the opportunity, come back and tell us what you've covered. Share your wisdom with us. Okay, Rich, are you ready for us now?
QSL.
Okie doke. What do you got today?
Okay, well, one just came up. Why on every band can you see on the waterfall, can you see the portion that's dedicated to digital? Why is it visible, strongly visible, on the waterfall if everybody's, you know, running like 2 watts?
Well, everyone isn't running 2 watts. I believe that a person who used to be our section director bragged a few times that she used maximum legal power for FT8. I think most people are using, you know, 40, 50, 60 watts. I could be wrong, but I don't think everyone's just using the 2 watts because, like I said before, the magnitude, and also you have to realize that these things, there are a lot of different people operating simultaneously very close to each other. And so for a lot of the resolution of pan adapters and waterfalls, it kind of merges together. So you're not really seeing one guy doing FT8. You're probably seeing 10 or 20 guys doing FT8. So that sort of adds to the blot that the waterfall produces.
Yeah, it's just amazing. You know, bands that look absolutely dead, no signals on the waterfall at all, they always have a digital representation of on the waterfall.
it's unbelievable, you know, how popular it is. I don't think I've ever gone to a band and have not seen at the frequency, like on 40 meters, it's 7.074. And I think 20 meters is 14.074. And then it varies on other bands, but I've never seen no activity. So I don't know. It doesn't do anything for me, FT8 or any of the digital modes, but I guess it does for a lot of other people. Go ahead.
AC2GS. It depends on your likes and your dislikes. So this has been very attractive to guys who are looking to collect wallpaper. You know, they love their certificates. They worked all states, worked all this, worked all that. And it's a relatively easy and low-tech way of accomplishing it. You could kind of, you know, there are ways to set the darn thing on automatic and have it do most of the work for you in the background. I once had a gentleman, I was chatting with him in the chat room during portions of the technical net while he was simultaneously running FT8 in the background. At the end of the technical, he told me he was somewhat dissatisfied, you know, because there was very little he had to do. It wasn't really a challenge. It was just setting up a machine and just going away, you know. It's sort of has the same kind of skill set that, the people who in the old days, early days with cryptocurrency would just get these the software that generated crypto tokens. And, you know, you could make money if you have a couple of GPUs and, you know, set them off to the side and you wanted to pay for the electrical bill for those types of things. So, yeah, it depends on the individual. It's very attractive to the people who are collecting certificates, and it's always active. I've never gone to 20 meters where FT8 is used and not see it active. I would first think that my antenna was faulty before I figured that the allure of FT8 had diminished.
Yeah, some people leave it running overnight or, you know, just to collect calls. I wasn't aware when I got into it. I wasn't aware that the software does the whole TISO for you. And then some people run Whisper overnight, you know, to see who can hear them around the world, but they do it overnight just to collect stations that can hear them overnight. Anyway, not my cup of tea. Okay, onward to the next question. I'm on this crazed drive to reduce noise in my radio. Let me let it drop. So, of course, that gets into ferrites. And I was wondering, on a power line, like the cable between your power supply and your radio, would that benefit from ferrites? And how does that differ from like a ferrite on a coax? Because they both, I think, reduce noise, but they're quieting very different things. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, you're going to get a lot better attenuation with a coax because you're operating in common mode. When you're using, two wires, standard power cords, it's differential mode. So it should kind of zero out the balance. People still do it. Also, if you happen to be using, for microphones, it's very useful because microphones usually have a coax wire as a conductor, and so you can have the common mode from RF leaking into your my cable. So people do it all the time. I would myself, on a theoretical basis, I don't think you're going to get a heck of a lot of attenuation because it's a differential mode current that you're operating. But people do it because ferrites are dirt cheap, relatively speaking.
Not if you get them from DX Engineering. I can't believe people who buy wire antennas from DX Engineering, they spend $200 on a dipole or an off-center fed dipole, where all they need is a 15-gauge spool, 100 feet of wire, and they could make their own up. And they buy these wire antennas. I never got it. But what is differential mode?
Differential mode is you have the current going in two different directions, so they balance out. You know, we talked about how the when you're sending a signal up your coax initially, the current is going through your current is going through two conductors. The inner aspect of the braid and the outer surface of the center wire. And each of those currents are opposite each other. So if one is positive, the other one is negative. If it's negative, the other one is positive. Common mode is when the two conductors, the outer shield and the inner shield, have the same phase relationship. When one is high, the other's high. So that's common mode, and the other one is differential that you see in all kinds of power wires because, you know, it's a very simple setup and it just has current going in the opposite direction on the opposing electrical conductor.
Okay. I asked you this earlier in the week, but, you know, for 40 meters, or for other bands too, 66 feet of wire, and going into a 49-to-1 transformer. Now, how come ferrites, if you clip them on the wire, before the wire goes into the transformer, how come that doesn't help anything?
Because, you want it to radiate. The idea of using RF chokes is you don't want the transmission line that's traveling inside your shack to be acting as an antenna. You do want the antenna to be acting as an antenna.
Is there any interaction between a ferrite and the wire?
Yeah, you're basically increasing the inductance of your antenna. It's like it would be as if you had you put a coil before you got to the antenna feed point, and that's going to detune the antenna.
So it's not only is it not needed, but it could be detrimental to use a ferrite clamp on a piece of wire going into a transformer. Is that right?
If it's part of the antenna system.
Yeah, well, of course the wire of an end-fed half-wave is part of the antenna system. I read, you know, if you're going to use the coax as a counterpoise on an end-fed half-wave to place ferrite beads 8 to 10 feet away from the transformer so it doesn't block the common mode currents and, in essence, you want to block the common mode currents after you're using after you're using the coax as a counterpoise. I always thought you either put it right at the feed point or you put them right at the radio. This said no. Put them about 10 feet from the transformer, and then the rest of it goes to the radio. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, but like anything, there's a lot of variable aspects to any antenna. It depends upon the dimensions of your NFED. It depends on your elevation. It depends on the topology around the environment. If there's conductors or just insulators or what have you, you need some degree of equipoise for optimal use of an NFED. But again, it depends. There's people who get by with a very, very short counterpoise. And there are others who run it all the way outside their shack, and they apply them at the boundary so that it limits to a certain degree the shack's exposure to RF. Or you could arbitrarily say 8 feet, whatever works for you. The beauty of these chokes is that you can sometimes just experiment with them. If you just use clamp-on chokes, you could slide them around and find the optimum counterpoise length for your given antenna and the frequencies that you tend to like to use them on.
What are the uses to try to cancel out some noises? What are the uses for ferrites are there? I mean, could you put them on the power cord of your washing machine, or your dryer, stuff like that?
Again, you could try, but since, those things are operating in differential mode, I'm not 100% how beneficial they are. But again, since other than DX Engineering, they're not that expensive, you could always experiment and try. People, put ferrites all over the darn place. There's no problem other than if you put it on the antenna. Too many ferrite chokes aren't going to really cause you any problems because primarily you're choking common modes, and there's no real good indication for needing common modes unless you're using it as a counterpoise, once again.
Yeah, well, counterpoise is very important in an NFED half-wave. I'm surprised a counterpoise doesn't have to be, a quarter wavelength, a half wavelength, like that. I'm surprised that they don't give hard and fast dimensions to an NFED half-wave counterpoise. Why is that?
Again, antennas are much more variable than we think they are. It's very important to understand that the height of your NFED is important, whether it's straight, whether it's crooked, whether it's upsloping, whether it's downsloping, and the environment around it, because there are metal conductors on objects near its near field that are going to detune it and change its how it works. So, unfortunately, just calling something an NFED half wave is not describing all of the variable aspects of them. And they're different for different configurations, and you don't really know unless you set it up in that environment and test it. Again, there are guys who find that choking it close to the feed point gives them the best performance, and others have different lengths because their environment that their antenna is in is not constant. And so all these things factor into what is the optimal counterpoise for a person's individual NFED halfway, That's why there's no absolute answer. No matter how many times you look it up, you'll find more common answers, but you're never going to find some guy who tells you, this is the answer. Stop looking.
Yeah, today I was in a park to do POTA, and the way it turned out, I had to have about 15 feet of the NFED half-wave wire on the ground. And I was wondering how much of a hit was I taking because that wire was on the ground?
Well, again, it's kind of difficult to say specifically. It's probably not a great idea if you have a choice, because you're going to get ground coupling and you're going to have some part of the aircraft going into the ground, and it's a inefficient design. So, it might be enough to get you out, but it's not the most efficient. One of these centuries, someone's going to be very clever and build a machine that tells you what your antenna efficiency is, and there's going to be a lot of hams that are very upset when they turn it on for the first time, because they'll be disappointed at the efficiency ratings of a lot of antennas that they assume are gangbusters. But you don't really know until you kind of experiment, and again, it's different. It depends also on the nature of the ground. Rocky ground is going to give you less loss than wet ground, sandy ground and stuff. So, it depends.
Yeah, I guess it's not hard and fast. What is the current calculation, the best calculation for antenna efficiency as we are here in 2025?
Okay. Unfortunately, it's the one that the military uses, or the ones who have millions of dollars of test equipment. The absolutely best method of calculating efficiency for antenna design is to build a big chamber and put the antenna in it, and then put a lot of field strength meters in three-dimensional space that feeds their information into a computer that then integrates all those readings in 3D space and gives you a final calculated energy RF output, and you just put in the input, and that's the efficiency. So without the RF meters and the anechoic chamber to put the antenna in, it's all just kind of putting your finger and sticking it in the wind to try and figure it out.
Yeah, I guess so. Us mere mortals who don't have the Defense Department, or the Department of War, I should say, to be accurate, budgets to do those things, I guess we just have to ignore efficiency. What are the antenna manufacturers going to do about that? Because they use that to sell antennas in their advertising.
Not to my knowledge. I've never seen an efficiency rating in an ad. And when you go to QST, they won't even tell you what the gain is for an antenna. Now, forget about the efficiency. They won't even tell you the gain.
I didn't know that. I thought there was an efficiency calculation or an efficiency number done. I guess people confuse efficiency with gain, or think that there's some correlation.
Probably. I mean, there are guys out there that if they look at two antennas and one of them reports that it has a gain of 3 decibels and the other one that it has a gain of 2.9 decibels, will immediately go to the 3 decibel gain. Like it really makes a difference. People don't really have an appreciation most of the time for what these differences amount to in real-life situations.
All right, last question. If I put two whips 15 feet apart, would one act as a radiator and the other act is the main element?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking. If it's the main element, it's radiating. So I don't know how you differentiate from the main unit and the radiator. I think you're getting it a little confused with Yagis. Yagis have parasitic elements that are not directly connected to the transmitter. and they act, they have different lengths, and so they have interactions, and effectively slightly longer element acts as a reflector, and a shorter element acts as a director. But in Yagi's, the only thing that's being driven is the driven element in the middle. The parasitic reflector and radiator are not connected to the drive source. They basically absorb the energy from the middle element that's wired into the transmitter, and then they radiate it either forward or back depending upon the phase relationship and the length of those elements.
Yep, that's what I meant. So would you have sort of like a vertical Yagi if you put two or three whips in line with each other?
Well, again, you can kind of drive them simultaneously. So you can have switched elements so that, you know, say you have three whips, and you can switch one in, or the second one in, or the third one in. You can change the directionality because of the interaction of the parasitic elements. So, yeah, it's possible to do stuff like that. You're not going to get a lot of gain, but you will get some.
Okay. All right. Well, that's about it, I think. As usual, you answered most of my questions with 99% efficiency. So back to net. This is W2BZ.
And one YDY comment?
Yeah, please.
It's talking about the three-element directional vertical that you can select which phase you're going to use. I agree that there's not a lot of gain to be had, but there is a little bit of selectivity with that. You can eliminate a noise source that's not in the direction you want to go.
Yeah, again, it's not going to be an obvious dramatic difference, but people have done it and it does work.
You're changing the pattern.
Yes, you're changing the radiation pattern, which is, that's what you're doing with the Aggies.
K2GJE, the elements have to be of the right length and of the right spacing. All this is on the internet.
Yeah, but it is doable. I mean, you can play around with electrically changing the physical nature of the elements if you're going to use them as reflectors or directors. But, you know, it is being done. You know, you can see them on the internet. You can see them on YouTube. Okie doke, this remains, it continues to be AC2GS. This is still the Limark Technical Net. We're still open for business. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics they'd like to roll around, please hit that push to talk.
Okay, N1YDY again. Now I have a question.
Certainly, Hank.
So I recently saw a J-pole antenna that was made out of copper in the standard plumber's delight type of thing for 2 meters. But the way the guy said it was he had a 4-to-1 coax ballon, and he then adjusted where it attached to the driven and reflector elements, or whatever the correct name for that stub element is, in order to get the 50-ohm impedance. And his big claim to fame was that it prevented common mode down the coax and made it work better on a particular frequency, made it more, what's the word I'm looking for, a sharper cue. Do you have any knowledge of these, and do you think this was kind of BS-ed, or does this sound like it's reasonable? I tried looking it up on the internet and didn't find anything, but I was fascinated by the way the guy built it.
Yeah, I think I saw articles. You know, there's a lot of articles on J-poles, And, you know, you could use a coax cable as a transformer just as well as anything else. So in principle, it works. And I think I've read in articles it works. I don't know if it gives you a dramatic benefit versus the ways of transforming the antenna feed impedance to 50 ohms nominal. But it certainly is doable, and I've read at least a few articles. I can't cite them because, you know, it's kind of like how many articles on quarter-wave ground plane antennas we've all read, hundreds at this point.
Well, I understand that. I just perhaps I just didn't pick the right words when I was doing the Google search, but I couldn't find anything, you know, when I was looking for it to see if there was any great advantage.
Yeah, I mean, the articles I've read didn't really go into the details of why it was better than other ways of matching impedances. It just was another method. So, again, not quite sure if there's any major benefit of this type of impedance matching versus other types. But you can certainly use this method to match impedances for something like a J-pole.
All right, thanks. And one mighty white clear.
Okey-doke, you're welcome, Hank. Once again, AC2GS here with the Limark Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for today, please feel free to push to talk.
WB2BXO. Yeah, very good voice. And I forget when I saw it. I know you sent me an email. I'm not even remembering off the top of my head what it was about, but it was interesting. Second of all, I'm wondering if any of the antenna simulation software, which, as I understand it, can give you gain, antenna patterns, etc., whether any of that would give you efficiency estimates, assuming, of course, you provided the software with enough information about the surroundings. So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's my understanding that it will give you numbers. What those numbers mean and how accurate is anyone's guess. I wouldn't really trust any of these numbers because, again, there's so many variables. It's very good to play around with the program, and you can kind of demonstrate a lot of useful stuff, and you could tweak designs, but you still have to ultimately tweak them in the real world. Otherwise, you're going to have some problems. But I think some antenna simulation software will provide you with an efficiency. I think we had a problem a couple, 6 or 8 or 9 months ago. Rich had this guy who's very famous this week on the Parks on the Air. He promotes his antenna designs, and basically he tells everyone to use radials and just raise them up a little higher so that they'll be more efficient. But I don't think he discovered that. But he kind of pulls out efficiencies that are semi-ridiculous. I would never trust anyone who told me any antenna is 98% efficient. You know, I don't think a piece of wire, you know, a piece of gold wire that's only 1 foot long is 100% efficient as far as you know, having, for all intents and purposes, zero resistance and such. So the bottom line is simulators can provide you with a number. I wouldn't trust the number personally.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, we can get a number, how good it would be, and how easy it is to validate that number is another story, since you can't really, as you say, without a lot of equipment the average ham does not have. You can't validate the number in the real world, so it would be hard to say if the software is any good. And you really can't tell on the air how efficient this, you know, it really is. And of course, 98% efficiency. I don't think there's anything in the RF world that is 98% efficient. Typically, I remember in the days when, I think before you were a ham, when we used to measure transmitter input power rather than output power, we generally assumed that our finals were 40 to 60% efficient, and if we were running a 250-watt Drake TR-4, as I was when I was a kid, that it was actually putting out somewhere between 100 watts or so, and in my case probably a lot less because I was using antennas that with ridiculous SWRs that were very inefficient. Go ahead.
Yeah, the efficiency of an amplifier is relatively easy to discern. You know, you just get take the power going into the linear amplifier and the power going out through the output connection to the coax and do a little simple math. So really the problem is when you include the antenna system into everything. You don't know exactly how much is getting reflected back, how much is being attenuated going forward and going backwards. The common mode, the radiation, there's so many little variables, and a lot of the causes for loss of efficiency are just not accurately discernible on antenna simulators. They sort of tend to take a best-case scenario. And when it comes to antennas, you can't really do a best case. It's maybe a worst case. You know, I Googled a whole bunch of different sources and trying to figure out, because, you know, the military does have specs on efficiencies based upon their incredible budget. And based on those Googles, I find that usually it's quoted that the most efficient antennas that technicians have measured tend to be somewhere in the 80% range. So again, you know, 98% is nonsense. I mean, you know, it's unless you can get your antennas from JPL and you only use superconductors, maybe, I don't know. Even then, you're probably not going to get 98%.
And I would suspect that 80% number is kind of a military contractor's wet dream that wants to charge the Pentagon a ridiculous amount of money for an allegedly 80% efficient antenna. Maybe I'm wrong, but I kind of doubt that's reality, and they know they could charge the Pentagon a lot of money, and that there's no way, and it would be very, very difficult to refute those claims and claw back the money from the contractor based on that.
Well, I don't know. It would be interesting to kind of talk to the civil engineer, military, and they have the equipment. If they really have the desire to find out if the manufacturer is snowing them, they could just roll it out to an anechoic chamber. They have a bunch of them, and run it through their field tests. You know, they're the only guys who could actually legitimately tell you what the efficiency of an antenna is if they really want to find out. You know, they have the budget to do that as many times as they want. So I don't know if anyone ever kind of had that experience. If they, If the military bought a design and it was guaranteed and they put it through its paces and discovered it was out of specs and penalized the manufacturer.
I don't know. It's an interesting question. I suspect that's been done. But I would also expect that in the end the manufacturer wasn't penalized just because even when we have a normal quote-unquote government thing, those things get very political. Go ahead.
It's certainly possible. I get their contracts because they know people who know people. So, it may be that they tested it. It was out of specs, but they said, well, it's not that far out of specs. That's the only kind of information I've been able to glean is Google searches and articles and such, where they vaguely tell you ranges of efficiencies. But this particular guy promoting his antennas, he'll put on his webpage 98% without even cracking a smile.